we've seen a big change in that more recently, which has been refreshing, that it's actually more helpful to know that your therapist is a human who struggles. So that was also, I think, part of the kind of motivation to write this the way that we did.
Yeah. And Michaela, I don't know if you know this, but you and your whole story's in the book. It was very personal. It's about your
all the details.
Because we have our client stories in there. So I just, you're the last one. But you know, if you get to the end, let me just tell your audience right now, it's Michaela, it's you.
Welcome to episode 161 of my podcast. I'm Michaela Peterson. In this episode, I spoke with Vanessa Bennett and John Kim, also known as the Angry Therapist. I met Vanessa in the spring of 2021 when I was taking care of my dad and he was very ill, and I was also navigating a divorce. And she helped bring in an outside perspective, because normally when things are going wrong in your life, I think if that continues to happen in your life, you're probably the issue. But sometimes it's also extremely bad luck. And I think if there's any health issues in a family, then that can just upset a lot of relationships as well. Vanessa really helped me through it, and she co-wrote a book with her partner, John, called It's Not You, It's Me. And it's meant to help people better negotiate their relationships and identifies a lot of couples' problems that many people deal with. So I brought them on to discuss their book, and we delved a bit into my past, my current relationship, their current relationship. It was a fun episode. I hope you guys enjoy it, and I hope you find it helpful. Before we get started, this episode of the podcast is sponsored by Rabbit Air. I just got up and shifted the camera slightly. Rabbit Air is always hanging out over there. There it is. You can see the purple glow. It is an air purifier. And given that fall is quickly approaching and almost here, now's a good time to buy an air purifier. I've always used them since I was a kid because I'm so allergic to the environment, but I think a lot of people could benefit from them, not knowing that they're having allergies to the environment as it is. We breathe in nearly 2,000 gallons of air a day, and I think a lot of people have micro allergies to dust or cats or cockroaches, if you're in an unfortunate situation that can, although I suppose if you're in that type of situation, you're probably not able to afford an air purifier. However, if for some reason you're living amongst cockroaches, probably buying an air purifier would be a good idea. That went in completely the wrong direction. If you're by the beach, you could be having dust allergies. If you're in Tennessee, you could be allergic to literally everything. Mold is coming around this time of year, but my favorite air purifier that I've ever had are these Rabbit Air purifiers. If you have a cat and you wake up congested, or you have kids that wake up with a stuffy nose, or you just want to sleep better, I would recommend going to rabbitair.com today to see their models. They've got very quiet, very good looking air purifiers. I have them in almost every room in the house. You can also call them 24/7 to speak to a Rabbit Air consultant. That is rabbitair.com. They're the brand I use, and I'm picky about brands and health. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Vanessa and John, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you for having us.
I've actually been following you, John, on Instagram for quite a while, the Angry Therapist. I don't know why, but it probably maybe 2 or maybe 3 years.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you got a good Instagram.
I hope I'm not disappointing.
I was waiting for you to say something like, I'm sorry.
there are no refunds.
No, it's good. Before we get started, I guess, can both of you give a brief background about who you guys are and what you do? Vanessa, you can start.
Yeah. So my name is Vanessa Bennett. I'm a licensed therapist out of Los Angeles, California. I am an author as of late, was a writer before that, but now officially an author. I am a mama to a 2.5-year-old, and I do all the things. So content creator, I run retreats, work with corporations to help them bring mindfulness and wellness into their spaces. I kind of have my hands in a lot of pots, but really working on relationships and specifically on healing from codependent tendencies in relationships.
I'm just a crazy Korean dude that meets people at coffee shops on his motorcycle. who started that actually after divorce. So like 12 years ago. And I started on Tumblr, and that was man, that was a long time ago. So yeah, licensed therapist, author, relationship dating coach, I guess.
A lot of books under your belt.
Yeah, a few.
Yeah. So do you help mostly men, or do you help men and women?
I mostly women, actually, just because it's changing now, but because I started this talking about heartbreak and love and, you know, relationships, I think it drew a lot more women than men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's changing a little bit more now.
Yeah. Now right? It's pretty even. Now it's like 50-50.
Yeah. It's been interesting, the increase in men wanting to and seeking out this kind of journey, I think.
Once I started posting about motorcycles and fitness and growing my hair out, I think I got some more men to follow me.
That's the way to go.
Yeah.
Motorcycles. Okay. So Vanessa, I know you, just to give a brief background. I've had like a number of therapists throughout my life, and most of them have gone terribly wrong. And then you actually helped me out when my dad was extremely ill and I was like navigating a separation, which ended up being a divorce. And you were extremely helpful, because I think from my background of being, I think being chronically ill probably played a role, but I had codependent issues that I didn't know how to navigate. So I had a difficult time knowing when to say no and not feel guilty about it. And I'm much, much better at it now. And I'm also much better since my family's healthier and I'm not around as many people that weren't good for me. That's obviously helped a lot. But that's the background from how you and I know each other. I think I reached out over Instagram when I was like, I need an outside person to tell me if the problems in my life, if I'm causing them, because if I'm causing them, I need to stop causing them. Yeah. And I think I wasn't causing a lot of them. So which was nice as well, I guess, maybe. But that's kind of the background. That's how I know you.
Yeah.
But I brought you guys on to talk about your book, because you have a new book that's coming out. I think when we release this podcast, it will be out. So it'll be linked below. But it's called It's Not Me, It's You, which I think can be extremely helpful for some people, not everybody, but some people to hear. So what made you guys decide to write this?
I've always wanted to write a relationship book. And I thought, what if I wrote it with my partner? And also, you know, her being a therapist, if she wasn't a therapist, that would be different. But I thought it would be interesting for two therapists who are a couple to write a book on relationships. But it was important to me that we came with you and not at you. It was important to me that we didn't stand behind a podium or point fingers. And that's why the title is kind of funny, right? Break the blame cycle. So yeah, I thought it was a great opportunity. But then when we started writing it, I realized, holy shit, this is very activating, because she's going to call me out on all my stuff. And for the book to be good, you got to go there. And so it was actually challenging kind of emotionally.
Yeah. And I think for me, when we broached the idea of writing it, it was important for me, but also for both of us, that we kind of pulled back this, you know, there's this misconception that therapists have their shit together and we don't. Like, we're just human and, you know, screwing it up just like everybody else. But also, I think a lot of the topics that we talk about in the book, I would say, are like the most common issues that we work with couples on when we're working in couples therapy, and also happen to be a lot of the most common issues that him and I work on in our relationship, right? So another way to just say, like, here's the basics. I mean, they're not basics. We go in pretty deep, but here's the basics of what we see a lot in ourselves. And then we go, you know, we give a lot of personal anecdotes. I mean, it's part memoir. So we don't really hide anything. We get really kind of open and honest about the stuff that we're dealing with. And I know from experience, and I know from working with clients, that this whole like being a blank slate as a therapist and pretending like you don't have a background, a story, your own issues, your own trauma is not actually helpful. You know, we've seen a big change in that more recently, which has been refreshing, that it's actually more helpful to know that your therapist is a human who struggles. So that was also, I think, part of the kind of motivation to write this the way that we did.
Yeah. And Michaela, I don't know if you know this, but you and your whole story's in the book. It was very personal. It's about your
all the details.
Because we have our client stories in there. So you're the last one. But you know, if you get to the end, Let me just tell your audience right now. It's Michaela. It's you.
Not true.
That's email, good. Huh? Well, it's already, it's already out.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. I actually think I'm going to put my experience in a book. I haven't written it though.
You should.
Yeah. I think I'm going to. I've written like.
You've been dabbling.
Yeah. And I've got like, I don't have the last couple of years, which were hard. And so I'm just waiting until I'm not like triggered all the time before actually just delving into it again, re-traumatizing myself accidentally.
So wait, all your relationship experiences or just the last one, that expiration?
No, more like my health issues.
Oh, okay. So
like more chronic health issues. That was like the most traumatizing thing. And then the last couple of years, it was like my dad being chronically ill, my mom. And I think it's probably going to be mostly about that when I'm feeling good and ready. I kind of want to just get it out though. Do you guys feel any relief getting it out? Or was it more like this is going to help a lot of people?
I think I do. I mean, I actually think there was part of our story that we wrote about, especially the beginning. We had a pretty rocky beginning. And I remember actually there was part of it that I wrote and we were on a Google Doc. So we were just kind of like passing it back and forth and doing it as we could. And I remember him coming in one morning after I had written this part being like, oh, that's kind of hard to hear. Like, I didn't know those specifics about, you know, I was basically talking about like this instance where I was kind of shit talking him with my friends and being like, fuck this, fuck him, fuck the relationship. And he was like, oh shit. Like, I didn't actually know that that was what was going on, but it was a little, I think, therapeutic for me to get it out. But also I kind of feel for our relationship to be like, well, let's get the real out on the table and actually talk about it, you know?
Yeah. You know, and also as a writer and a, you know, / artist, no art is good unless it's honest, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's the inner conflict between, okay, I want this to be good and I want it to resonate. And in order to do that, I have to show myself or be honest. That's also going to impact Vanessa. We're going to have opinions about it. So it was a little bit complicated in that way because all my other books I wrote by myself. So it's juicy. And the audiobook is both of us, you know, hitting the ball back and forth and talking our parts, so it feels almost like a podcast.
Yeah, but for you, I almost
feel that's like, cool.
It's one or the other. It's like writing it when you're still close to it is either going to be amazing, and that's actually going to be like the fuel to make it amazing, or it's going to be a little too much. And I guess that's just going to have to be something you like navigate, dip in, dip out, dip in, dip out.
Yeah.
And also, writing is rewriting. So I would write it now while it's
like
fresh, just
like a bad copy. I have like journal entries. Yeah. I've got journal. I wrote throughout like the entire experience. So I've got it all written down. Yeah. This is the detailed version now.
I like writing as rewriting. That's a really good way to look at it.
Yeah, it just depends on when you stop. It's like, you know, I think writing a book is like having a baby. Not that I've had a baby, but you have this idea. And then as you feed that idea, it starts growing. Like you're journaling, you know, we start writing, sketching, and then suddenly, you know, it's too far to turn back. And now you have to And it does take about 9 months, you know. It's some days are painful. Some days, you know, you're just staring at a blank screen. Other days you're in that flow state. And then you give birth to it. And then, you know, it comes to your door and you hold it in your hand and you're like, holy shit, this was an idea. And now it is in my hand. And then there's this kind of like letting go, meaning
you can't change it once it's there.
Yeah, it's dried cement. And then it's going to go and it's going to do what it's going to do, you know. And then, of course, the insecurities you have, are people going to like it, you know, all of that stuff. So it's a really roller coaster of a ride.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. There's definitely something to that. When you start to write, then it becomes something that you can't really get rid of until it's done. Just this like heavy thing, like got to finish it, get it out. It's weird, huh? Yeah.
It's very therapeutic.
Yeah.
Can be.
That's why we tell everybody to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's it like? What's it like being with another therapist?
Horrible. I wouldn't recommend it. It's
a terrible idea.
Yeah, it's a shitty idea.
I think people have this idea that we like sit around and analyze each other all day. That is not the case. It's like my therapist hat's either on or it's off. And when it's off, I'm probably not functioning from my higher self all the time. So it's not like we're walking around therapizing each other.
Yeah. You know, we have our own shortcomings. We have our own issues. Our relationship isn't easy. You know, we talk about it in the book. When we met, we already had, kind of stepping on each other's toes, hurting each other. And so there's residue there. So yeah, it's like any other relationship, you know. Yeah. But I do think as a therapist, I feel a more of a responsibility to check myself because I don't want to be the do as I say, not as I do guy. So there is a little bit of that pressure. It's like being a fitness trainer. And if you let yourself go, you're like, oh, I do this shit for a living. So I, you know, hold. So there is a little bit of that.
That's true.
But as people, Vanessa is just as fucked up as anyone out there every day. It's just like, yeah. So,
I'm not going to contest that.
Okay. I think something people might find helpful. So what are the common relationship problems people go to you guys with?
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know the exact number, but let's just say there's like 10 chapters in the book. We tried to kind of break it down based on the categories that we saw the most, right? So just kind of name a few differences in attachment styles, right? It's always a big one. Kind of what happens when you get really activated? Where do you go? Do you pull back? Do you cling, right? Do you tend to be more avoidant or anxious?
I'm more anxious attached. Vanessa's more avoidant, right? So I'm holding onto her leg. She's running the other way, that kind of thing. After, you know, a decade, we have both worked on ourselves where we're swimming towards secure. I'm not as anxious as I was in my 20s, and she's not as avoidant, but it's still there, right? So that's that's a big one. Different love languages.
Yep, love languages.
I write, I'm a writer, so Vanessa as well, but my love language is, tell me I'm attractive, tell me I'm sexy, write me poems. Like, that stuff goes far with me. I also express myself in that way.
That makes me so uncomfortable.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
I feel that.
Yeah. Vanessa's like, let me go get the car washed. If you love me, you know, do the dishes. Like, so she's acts of service.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And vice versa, I show it that way too. And so it's really interesting because we actually take a lot of these kind of like pop psychology type ways of looking at relationships. And we did try to bring it down to whether or not you actually subscribe to like love languages as a thing. It's like, there is something to be said for the fact that giving him words makes me really uncomfortable and it's really hard for me. And I need to learn to work with my discomfort around that because it's really important that I show him love in the way that he needs to hear love. Otherwise it's going to be me missing him constantly. So love languages was a big one for us.
Michaela, what's your, how do you give and receive love? What comes naturally to you? Acts of service, words of affirmation, physical touch, quality time, or gifts.
So I think it's changed, right? Because
it usually does.
I've had a number of relationships, and I think with relationships that I was in that weren't as good, I thought that I wanted something different. I was like, gifts seem like a good idea. But then being in, like, I'm very happy where I'm at now. And so like touch is like, well, I'm way more interested in that than I have been like ever before. And I was like, oh, I thought I just wasn't into that, but no, I was just with the wrong people.
Yeah.
And so I would say probably words of affirmation. I don't know. Do you know why people have different?
So there is a theory. So more recently, so the guy who wrote the original love languages book, Gary Chapman, it wasn't like a research study. He really just pulled this based on his experience in his own practice. But they've started to actually do some research around this theory. And one of the things I find really interesting is that they're starting to be able to correlate what you feel like your love language is, as in how you receive love. For most people, you can attribute it to what you did not get when you
ever. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I've
heard that.
That to me like blew my mind when I heard that, because I was like, not only does that make sense for me, but I can see how that's really helpful for a client to understand that, right? And also for the partner to hear that. So like, again, if it's uncomfortable for me to give him words, knowing maybe that comes from this kind of childhood place, right? This childlike need for words and to be seen in that way, it makes it almost easier for me to give it to him, because there's something about when you see your partner in that light, right? In that more vulnerable kind of childlike state, that drops a lot of defenses. You don't personalize things so much. And you essentially say like, I have to get over my discomfort with this because his like inner child needs this.
My mom made my bed, but rarely said, I love you.
Yeah.
You didn't like, Like, I get that. I think it was similar in my family, like my family. And I think there were like downsides and benefits from that. I know for my dad, it was like, he held me to a really high, like extremely high expectations. And I also am not entirely sure if I would have accomplished as much as I have accomplished without those high, like being right. pushed like that. So, but there wasn't a lot of, and I think part of this was from being ill all the time. So there's a lot of focus on me being ill, but there wasn't a lot of like positivity. And that also could have been shadowed by like my depression. Mm-hmm. So I also didn't pick up on positive things. So I don't even know what happened, but my experience was there wasn't a lot of positivity. And so right. I think that's probably why I react well to the words of affirmation. And then I probably give it out with touch. Yeah. Why do you think, Vanessa, you're uncomfortable? Because I'm definitely in the same kind of boat. Like, I like it. But at the beginning, I really didn't like receiving it. I was like, oh, I didn't even know how to receive a compliment. And I definitely have a difficult time saying, like, good job to people, but which is messed up.
Very common for those who struggle with codependency to have a hard time accepting compliments.
Michaela, you look very beautiful.
Weird.
Great.
Yeah,
great,
no. Great no, podcast. Don't do it. No, just like, stop.
Okay, the podcast is over.
Like, we're done. So also have a hard time. So some of the research that I've done around that specific topic, people who have a hard time hearing and really believing compliments, right? So we can do
yeah.
just like saying thank you, but doesn't necessarily mean that I believe it. A lot of it has to do with if you have a belief deep down inside that you are not whatever that person is telling you, right? So I think you're so amazing. I think you're so intelligent. I think you're not only just beautiful. I mean, it could be physical attributes, but it could be attributes about you as a person. For those of us who have a deep belief that maybe we don't actually check those boxes, it actually feels a little bit like, and this is all kind of happening unconsciously, right? It's this belief that we're somehow being fraudulent by accepting that compliment, which is very uncomfortable. And so we'd rather deflect and dismiss it because we actually truly don't believe what you're saying deep down inside, right? So it feels like we're not being honest. It's really interesting.
I think also there's, you know, there are many layers, and I think also what you're used to in previous relationships, you know. So
I've never been okay with it. I've never been comfortable with it, I guess. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've had it from other people, and I've still
right.
been comfortable.
Right. So for me, if I'm used to words of affirmation,
yeah,
and then you're not a words of affirmation person,
it
feels different. There's going to be that wanting that from you, thinking that's the norm. Thinking, you know, something's wrong with you because I've gotten in so like the comparing that we do, you know, with previous relationships, yeah. right?
And I'm sure you guys both have had clients that have asked you this, and I've definitely asked Vanessa this. How do you identify when you're in a situation when you want to say no, and you shouldn't feel guilty about saying no? Because there are situations where, I think there are still situations where you kind of want to say no, but like really, you should give somebody help. Mm. How do you differentiate between when you should actually help somebody and when you should say, no, I can't do that. I need to focus on me, which sounds selfish, but like, it's not selfish if you're taking care of yourself, which is taking care of your family, which is going to make the relationship better in general, right? But how do you tell the difference?
I mean, the way that I usually talk about it, I also think it depends on, this isn't a blanket statement for everyone, because I think it depends on your struggle with boundaries and your struggle with saying no and asking for your needs to get met, kind of coming into this work. So if you're somebody who struggles to say no, if you're somebody who struggles to get their needs met, most likely once you start working with boundaries, you can expect that it's going to feel a little bit like selfish walls. It's going to be a lot like bam, bam, bam in your face, right? And that's uncomfortable for everybody. And that's not probably how it's going to stay. For a lot of people, we actually need to swing to the other side of the extreme spectrum before we figure out what kind of middle ground feels like. So if I'm somebody who's not used to saying no, I say yes all the time, and then I just sit with all that resentment. Mm-hmm. If I start saying no, most likely it's not going to come off very nice. I'm probably going to say maybe more no's than I really should, even though I don't like that word. And so I need to sit in the discomfort of what the other extreme feels like in order to go, oh, well, that actually doesn't feel that great either. So now I know both extremes very well in my body. And so now I can kind of start to feel into what middle ground would feel like, right? And on top of that, I would say just we have to get really familiar with, and I know we've talked about this before, you and I, this feeling of resentment, right? Because it's such a good indicator for us that we are doing, giving more than we probably should be doing, right? And so if we can use resentment as a barometer for, I need to check in, what's going on, right? Where am I saying yes that I shouldn't? Is there a conversation that should be had? Then typically, I don't think it's going to be perfect all the time. I think just by nature, we're going to do things we don't want to do sometimes. We're going to, you know, come across selfish sometimes. All that's going to happen. But I think those are some tools to at least maybe work your way towards a more happy medium, you know, that balanced state. That's the way that I, as somebody who has a hard time with boundaries, those are usually what I use, right? I'm very familiar with, oh, I'm in an extreme right now. I can sense it now. And then I'll say, okay, pull it back. But I have to be really aware of my resentment because otherwise it's no good for the relationships.
Do you feel that you're in the stage of your life where your nose are on the pendulum swinging the other way, or have you come kind of in the middle?
No, I think I'm pretty good right now. Like, I think I'm pretty good. And I think that's because I'm mentally healthy right now. And well, it helps when nothing bad is happening too. It's a lot easier to like be a reasonable person if you're not in some chaotic either relationship or with health issues or, you know, something like that. It's a lot easier to be like, yeah, everything's good right now. No, I don't think my no's are, I'm a pretty disagreeable person. So I say no a lot in work. I still work with my dad quite closely, and so he gets a lot of requests, and so a lot of that job is no sorry. So that helped me get good. I think that helped me get good at saying no quite quickly. I think I'm doing pretty well.
Or via Pardon? Email then it is to your partner.
In regards, so my partner, my husband, he's unbelievably disagreeable and he's really emotionally stable. So if I say no to him, he just doesn't care at all, which made it so much easier because, you know, I think part of what happens to people is they don't want to say no because they don't want to hurt the other person's feelings. And right. Every time they're like kind of saying no and the other person's freaking out, they're like, oh, okay. Never mind. Like, this isn't a big deal for me. Yeah. I'll just say yes for now. It's fine. Obviously it's upsetting you. And with Jordan, he just doesn't care at all. I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. He's like, fine. And that's kind of it.
When you say he's disagreeable, you mean he also is really good with his nose?
Yeah, like he won't do anything he doesn't want to do. So that makes it super easy. Yeah, right. It's like just very clear.
So because he's boundaried, he respects your boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's probably helped me with it too. Being like, oh no, you don't want to say yes to that. You don't want to do that. You're like, yeah, I don't really want to do it, but like, I should do it. Like, nah, you don't have to do it. Like, oh, sweet. Okay, great. This episode is sponsored by NordVPN. If you're at all concerned with data privacy, NordVPN is an easy-to-use security measure that gives you a base level of internet protection. While it may seem silly to protect your data when you aren't doing anything wrong on the internet, even though the most innocent of us do have data secrets online, like sensitive passwords and financial information, a VPN's encryption and identity protection services are like a lock on the door, or in other words, a basic security measure that I use and have used for a very long time, mostly so I didn't get in trouble from downloading movies online. Used to get those emails where they knew that you were the one downloading movies. That freaked me out. Anyway, I've been using a VPN since then. Nord's virtual private network protects you against anyone who wants to exploit your online movement, whether it's a lone hacker or an overreaching government. NordVPN shields you from government agencies, websites that collect and sell your data, and your own internet service providers. Kind of crazy that you have to be kind of like, okay, maybe I don't want the government to have my data, but I guess that's life now. Encrypt your online activity and hide your IP address to guarantee that your personal information doesn't end up where you'd least want it to be. Grab your NordVPN deal today over at nordvpn.com/TMPP or use promo code TMPP for 61% off. That's a huge discount off their premium plan and their free anti-malware feature. Hopefully that's what I used when I signed up, TMPP. Not sure if I did. All with NordVPN's 30-day money-back guarantee. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
I think every relationship, whether we're talking about intimate relationships or friendships or with family, every relationship requires compromise. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, it's the compromise of self. when you can start to say no. You know, like if you feel that you are, because there's going to be times you do things you don't want to do. Of course, you know, it's like helping move. Who wants to do that? Or picking up someone from the airport? It's all part of it.
I don't do that.
Well, now
I say no.
Yeah. I say no
before the Ubers. And so, in a marriage or in any relationship long term, of course, you're going to be doing things like picking up socks or doing whatever. But if it gets to the point where you are now compromising self, then it's something to really look at. And I think that for me, that would be the piece, you know, not getting your needs met because you're saying yes too much, or having to draw lines because you're saying, yes, things that you don't want to do or whatever. So I think it's not a one-time thing. I think it's over time, you sensing, okay, now I feel like I'm compromising myself. Then it's, you know,
I think for a lot of people in the beginning of that journey, though, they actually don't even know what that feels like or what that means, because they've so overcorrected, right, into the kind of bad area of no boundaries, that they have no sense of self. And so I actually think if anybody who's listening is somebody who struggles with boundaries, starting like very basic and just tapping into like, what does this specific no feel like? Because even picking up socks can feel so much bigger than just picking up socks.
Well, yeah, if you've been doing it for your entire life.
That's what I'm saying.
So so are you also at a place where your pendulum has swung, where you're very no right now, as opposed to if you're very yes, a yes person?
I think I was. I think I'm in the state right now where I'm finding my way to middle. Yeah. I think it depends on the person, the type of no, it's all circumstantial, but
with intimate relationships,
I think I'm edging towards middle.
So when you met me 5 years ago, you were more of a yes person.
Yes.
And then you swang to the no person.
Yes.
And now you're coming back.
Now I'm working my way.
So do you know when you'll be in the middle? Maybe in a week? just so you know, I know what's happening. It's an injection of hope.
I can't promise anything.
Because I take no's crush me. You know, I think sometimes I take, so rejection for me is hard. I'm not used to it. I personalize it. I internalize it. So if Vanessa says to me, you know, no, I don't want to, you know, whatever, have dinner because I'm busy, that's not that big of a deal. But if it's a personal thing that she says no to, then that fall is harder for me.
Well, here's what's interesting about that. So what you were talking about, Michaela, with Jordan, the fact that he's so good at boundaries has helped you get better at boundaries. Now, I would say, John, you're pretty accurate in that. Like when I do say no, I can see him deflate and take it very personally. My usual go-to used to be, I have to fix it, right? He's feeling uncomfortable or hurt or upset by the fact that I said no about something. So now it's my job to fix it and make him feel better, which then just kicks me back into the kind of resentment cycle, caretaker cycle all over again. So the mirror that I get from somebody like that in a relationship is actually just the ability to go, I don't need to fix this. It's okay that he's upset. He's allowed to be upset. And I can just let him be upset. That's okay. That's not my job to fix it for him, right? So there's like two different kind of lessons I feel like you're going to get from somebody more like your husband versus somebody who does kind of personalize it. And because I am a fixer, it used to be my go-to to try to soothe that for you versus being like, it's okay. He's allowed. You're allowed to be upset.
How do you know, and of course someone shouldn't go fix something because every relationship's 50-50, but how do you know where it requires attention, right? So a lot of times the nose, you know, it might be a sensitive area that requires a conversation, right? So maybe it's not even about what the person's saying no about, but something that's running deeper. So yes, if you have a story where you're usually the fixer upper or the fixer, you grew up fast, you're taking care of people at a young age, all that. Sure, that's a pattern that can be unhealthy and damaging. But at the same time, once you're in a relationship, being aware of, is this something that I don't want to do because I'm so used to fixing it?
Yeah.
Or is it something that we need to talk about because it requires fixing on both parties, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's like interesting.
Right now, I would say that, it's in this specific example. So if we're just using you and I as an example, in this specific instance, if I'm usually the fixer and I'm working on, it's not my responsibility to fix this for you, right? Or self-soothe you or whatever. In this instance, I would say it would be your responsibility to come to me and say, can we talk about this no and why it's bothering me? not my responsibility to say, hey, I sense that you're upset by my no.
Sure. So not chasing after me.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
But also not avoiding the conversation.
Right. I think we just
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
Relationships are hard. It's very abstract.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is super abstract. I'd say, I think with like my experience with Jordan, if we get into an argument, I would say generally if he's upset because of like who he is, he doesn't get upset. Mm-hmm. If he's upset, then I'm like, okay, we need to talk about this. So it's, mm-hmm. I think at the moment anyway, I have it pretty easy because it's like, there isn't, it's pretty cut and dry. And then it's like, oh, if there's a problem, it's probably something that needs to be addressed. Mm. But I don't know. It's new. We've known each other for a year.
Are you the one that's bringing it to him and saying like, there's a problem we should talk about, or does he come to you, or both?
No, I think probably both. I still have a tendency to like, if I'm in an argument and I can feel myself getting angry, I think because I had like years and years of arguing that I just like, I'm probably avoidant. He's mentioned something about being avoidant. Yeah. Like, oh, we're, this is getting into a fight. Nah. Like, yeah, and yeah. Then I move into shut like, it, I'm not even, I don't even get upset first. I don't even know if I get angry. Right. Yeah. I just go numb. Like something's like walls go up and I'm like, no, I'm not even doing this at all. But I seem to get over that quite quickly. So I'm like, oh, I'm not feeling anything. Am I feeling angry? Actually, you taught me this. You're like, yeah, you're like, what are your emotions? You said something this way. I was like, I don't know, like angry, sad. You were kind of like, yeah, like a 3-year-old. Like, is there any background to those emotions? Yeah. I was like, well, I'm not sure. So then, yeah, I'm like an emotion wheel. Like, what are you actually feeling? So I probably still use that where I'm like, I'm feeling numb. I'm feeling angry. I'm like, angry is covering something though. Like angry isn't the emotion. Mm-hmm. And I get angry instead of feeling sad all the time. Like, yeah. I don't want to feel sad and hurt and like weak. I'll feel angry. It's like a positive emotion. It's much more pleasant than feeling sad and crushed.
Or so we've been taught that it's a positive emotion.
Yes. Right? Or so we've been taught.
Society has told us that anger is safe and healthy because sadness is weak, right? Because that's what we've been told. Or
it
that.
Feels weak though. It's hurts. It hurts. And anger doesn't really hurt like that.
Mm. Well, I mean, anger is also a very motivating emotion.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it can be something that moves you into action. And so feeling like you have action can feel much more empowering than feeling like, oh, I'm just sitting in sadness, which feels the opposite, right? It feels like almost disempowering.
Yeah. And I don't know if society labels anger as
better.
Yeah, usually people think anger is a bad thing. And sometimes anger can be healthy if you don't allow yourself to be angry. Mm. You know, as long as you're not destructive.
Right, healthy rage. Versus...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anger, I think, can be and I'm not just saying this because I call myself the angry therapist, but anger isn't always bad. Anger can be a good thing.
Yeah.
If anger is something that you default to, then yes, that can be bad. And you have a temper and you know, you're short to, you know, if you're like rageful, but
or you hide behind it, like Michaela was saying, right? Like I just go there and I stay there because that feels better, you know, as long as it's not like the hiding behind.
But if you don't allow yourself to be angry and you hold things down and that's your pattern, then being angry may be the prescription.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that. Do you think that's more the case with men, or do you think that's across the board? I can say like men who
There are a lot of angry men. I mean I was one of them. I mean, in my 20s I was angry and reactive, because I think for men we don't have a lot of, you know, like we were saying, the 3-year-old for men, we have the primary colors of feelings. It's like we're angry, we're sad, we're horny, or, you know, we're very kind of like a quote unquote basic in that way.
But why though? Because that's not how you're born.
No, because we don't, I shouldn't say we, because I don't want to generalize this, but I think men don't drop into their body and allow themselves to feel because we're fixed or up. We fix things or we're logical or we don't allow ourselves to feel. So anger, it becomes a common, default.
But that I would say you're raised that way, right? So the research shows that the brains of males and females are not actually that different at all, especially the emotional areas, right? Like the amygdala and all the places in the brain that we feel emotion. That's a socialized thing. So men are socialized to be able to tap into anger as like, that's the safe emotion. So men aren't labeled bad or wrong for showing anger and aggression and all the good things that come from that, right? Oh, he's such a go-getter. He's such a, you know, he's successful at work because he channels that kind of anger and rage. Obviously with women, it's the opposite, right? Nobody wants to be the angry, the bitch, or all the words that we have for women when they're angry. We don't have those same kind of words for men when they're angry, right? So I think there's really interesting turn right now where I think men and women both are coming to the table saying, how can we feel more than just what we've been told we're allowed to feel, right? And it's creating a really, I think, really interesting dialogue, especially like in heteronormative couples, where we get to say like, let's rewrite our rules, you know, let's get out of these boxes that we've kind of been put in.
Yeah, I think me growing up, I definitely probably ended up with more of a male, and I've taken personality tests and I am fairly disagreeable, but I think I ended up with more of a like masculine personality, and it's been helpful for me to try and work on the more feminine part that I just didn't like, that I viewed in a negative way. Right. And I do think that was mainly from being chronically ill. And I used a lot of anger to channel my way through that. Cause it was like, if I just felt like I was like death all the time,
yeah,
and there's no fix, then it's like, okay, well you just have to like be strong and get through it. There's no like feeling that if you're just going to be chronically ill forever. But then since I got healthy, I think it's been difficult for me to be like, to feel things more, because it is kind of uncomfortable. Like just being angry when things are hard is easier. And it was for me anyway, but I think it's been almost like a relief to try and be like, oh, I can be vulnerable without getting hurt. Like if you're in a situation where you're going to be vulnerable and then someone's just going to jab you, right, there's no point in being vulnerable.
Right.
Like you have to.
This is the thing too, that I think a lot of like the disservice on this like pop psychology, social media shit that we're on right now is that we're all about let's learn to feel our feelings, but there has to be a balance of also building the muscle of discerning and discernment, right? And they have to go hand in hand. Otherwise, to your point, you're going to be getting jabbed left and right. So it's not to just say, hey, let's rip up the facade and just feel all the feels, because that can be crushing if it's not done smart, right?
I wonder if an abundance of masculine energy, so Vanessa has a lot of that, stems from your upbringing being in a state of survival and fight or flight, right? So
totally.
Feminine energy, you know, the nurturing side.
Soft, receptive.
It's hard to tap into that if you're living life thinking the sky is falling and you have bills to pay and you have responsibility.
Yeah.
Grow up fast. So
yeah,
it almost forces you to produce masculine energy as a way of to survive.
Totally.
You know? And so then you become an adult, you get into relationships and you realize this and you want to now tap in more into your feminine energy, because that's what's needed, right?
For both men and women, right?
Yeah, for both men and women, right? Yeah. And that's really hard to do because of why we're not used to that. Like, how do you do that? It's like brushing your teeth with the opposite hand. How do you, where, I don't know what that means, right?
Okay. So where do I even begin?
Yeah. Mm. But yeah. You know, what we're talking about is one of the things that Vanessa and I, you know, are dancing with and stepping on toes. And
we talk about this in the book too. Yeah. It's like, you know, we jokingly will talk about how when we first met, our biggest difference was that I'm from New York and he's from LA, because culturally it's like a major difference.
Yeah.
But even in that, right, I have more of the masculine energy. The Northeast of America, it just is that very blue collar, right? Like there's an energy about it. It's a lot of kind of rough and tumble, pull yourself up by your bootstrap. Mm-hmm. It's cold, it's gray, you know, and the West Coast is not like that. Like
smoothies and sunshine.
Exactly. And so when we first met, I was like, oh no, this
air in my face.
I have this funny story. When we first met, we were kind of like jokingly playing around and I was laughing and I went, oh, whatever, fuck you. And he looked at me like, what? And he goes, can we not say fuck you to each other? And I was like, whatever. That's a term of endearment in New York, you know? And it's just so funny to see the difference in even just how upbringing.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I had the same experience.
I was not used to that. I'm not being used to my partner saying fuck you.
Yeah, well, no. And I honestly think that's probably more normal. I had the same experience with Jordan and he was like, you can't say that. And I was like, yeah, I guess that's kind of mean. But like,
see, I was like,
everybody does it. Everybody does it. And maybe that's more of a East Coast thing. I'm from Toronto. So kind of same kind of area.
Yeah.
And he's from California. Mm. So Californians are soft.
I would put you more in like my energetic sphere, because Toronto's only like an hour and a half from where I grew up in upstate New York. So, or 2 hours. So it still has that same vibe. Cold winters, gray, harsh. Most people are blue collar. I mean, you know, at one point, and it's just different. It's a different energy.
Hey, yeah. You like elbow people walking down the street.
Right. Yeah. No, you don't smile and say hi. It's like,
yeah.
When we first met, and I'm saying this because it's in the book and we've also said it in many podcasts. When we first met and we're dating, because I'm a little bit kinky, we're getting intimate. I said, hey, can I slap you? And she said, if you slap me, I'm going to slap you back. And I was like, oh, that's not going to work.
It's very serious.
So lots of dominance.
So that in itself shows you the difference in energy. I was like, I mean, yeah, but I'm going to slap you back. And I was not trying to be kinky.
That doesn't work with the role playing. It's not hot.
That's like, oh, that's funny. Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think how much of that is how you're brought up though? And how much of it is also how you're born? I don't think I would be as disagree. Like I can, now that I can say, I used to be able to say no. Here's the thing. I used to be able to say no because it was part of my job. And I was like, if somebody needed to be fired or let go, I'd be like, I can do it. I can do it. So it wasn't like to everyone. It was just to certain people where it's like, can't say no to them. Mm-hmm. It was like isolated.
Sure.
But I was like that at work too. I mean, before I became a therapist, I was in advertising for 10 years, kind of grind, climbing the ladder. I was a director of like a 20-person team at some point. And I was always really good at holding firm and holding
boundaries. Yeah.
It was like, people used to call me bad cop. Like I was bad cop. My partner was good cop because I was the one that was like, nope, not doing that. You know? But when it came to intimate or vulnerable relationships, that was where suddenly it changed. And I didn't have the same kind of, I don't know, backbone, if you will, when it came to saying no. So I think,
Is that partly, I mean, I don't know your experience, but I feel like, is that partly from not being in relationships that made you feel safe?
Partly.
Because it's a lot easier to be like, I'll do what you want if it's like, I don't know what's going to happen if I say no, exactly.
That's exactly it. It activates that abandonment fear, you know, that wounding, that like, if I say no, you're going to abandon me. And maybe not necessarily physically, but maybe emotionally, like you're going to be upset with me. You're going to cold shoulder me. A lot of us that grew up in families where either the parents cold shouldered you when they were mad at you, or they yelled at you, but they didn't necessarily explain, like had real emotionally connecting conversations. We as children, we embody that as rejection, right? That's like abandonment of self. And so I'm going to do anything I can to make sure that I don't feel that feeling or that fear of abandonment. And if that means saying yes when I want to say no, then that's something I learned to do.
I think it's also not practicing it.
Right. It definitely is like
for a muscle
atrophied. Yeah.
So how could people, say somebody's listening to the podcast thinking, okay, I'm resentful. Mm-hmm. Like,
welcome to the club.
All. yeah, resentful. So like let's start even a step back. How would you guys describe what being resentful feels like so people can identify what resentment feels like?
I have the best, for anybody who knows Glennon Doyle, she was able to articulate this in a way that I love and I now use all the time. She says that for her, when she knows she's feeling resentful is when she has the thought, must be nice. And I was like, oh, I love that. That's exactly what it is. The second you're looking at somebody thinking, must be nice, you know that there's resentment there, right? And a lot of us know that feeling of must be nice. You know, whether it's in her instance, it was like her partner, Abby, kind of relaxing and like hanging out and watching soccer and relaxing her day's work. And she would look at her and think, must be nice. But why was she doing that, right? Like nobody was telling her that she wasn't also allowed to sit down and relax. It's just that her upbringing, her wiring, all her codependent bullshit was telling her she had to be constantly moving, constantly productive, constantly cleaning, constantly whatever. And so she started realizing when she would do the must be nice that there was resentment there, which needed a conversation. So that's been really helpful for me.
And also, you know, if you're resentful, you have to explore how much of it is warranted.
Yep.
And then how much of it is
yours to own.
Yours to own. Yeah. You never even expressed anything. You're just harboring, you know, this kind of anger. So resentful, I think, is also worth exploring. It's not black and white. You totally. Know, it doesn't automatically mean that someone did something wrong.
Yep. Usually resentment is yours to own. I mean, usually resentment is yours first and foremost to explore. And then you have the conversation if you feel like you.
Well, the ownership piece is you waited too long. It's almost like, you know, if the peaches went bad or the bananas are now, you know, black, you waited too long. And so like resent, that's probably a horrible.
No, I kind of like that actually.
Okay,
I
mean, good.
We'll go with that.
I'm brilliant. Root. So if you're already feeling resentful, I think it's a great sign that your responsibility was to talk about it, express it, do something about it before. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's too late.
It's gone bad.
But it's gone bad. It's now sour.
Yeah. But some of us don't know until it's gone sour that it's gone sour.
Because that's what we're used to.
Right.
Because we don't exercise. Hey, listen, what you did hurt me, or I feel rejected, or here's a need that I have, or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
Or I pick up the socks too much, or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how do people who are walking around in a cloud of resentment, how do they start to put up boundaries to try and get rid of that? What's like the first step, especially if you've been stuck in it for like 5 years?
Yeah.
Like, I haven't mentioned that I don't like this for 5 years. Like, what do I do? Hey, should have said something.
About boundaries. I think it's about bridges. I think if you feel that you have anger and resentment, it's a sign that you need to do something about it. And maybe starting with the therapist or a coach, but ultimately talking to your partner and expressing the anger. You know, I have actually a real life example. My ex-wife, who we like after 10 years actually sat down at a Korean barbecue, you know, just had an amicable chat, and we hugged. It's the kind of hug where it's like, I'll probably never see you again, but have a great life, right? It was that kind of like hug, understanding. I thought all was forgiven. And then months later, I got an email, and holy, about, oh my God. I mean, some of the stuff she said, it just blew me away, which meant she was still carrying resentment and anger. And I was thinking to myself, how come you didn't tell me, even at the Korean barbecue, that you were still mad about things? You're still mad, you know? And so, the banana went black. I feel like you have a responsibility to start telling the people that you're resentful toward why. And, you know, and also not just blaming, because that's not going to work, right? You don't just say, you know,
you did this and now
you
I'm
did
resentful.
This. And yeah, I've been picking up your socks for 10 years and you're, I mean, maybe you do that to your therapist, right? To get that. And then you go to your husband, dad, friend, whatever, say, hey, listen, here's what I feel. And if they're able to hold that space for you,
which is the big key.
Yeah. And then many are not, right? Many will blame you back. But if they are able to hold that space for you, and that's why it's important to come in not hot or defensive, right? You can come at your therapist like that and then come in more of a, hey, listen, I care about this relationship and this is why I'm telling you, man, I still feel some resentment for this or what happened. And if they're able to hold that, then the resentment starts to dissolve. Mm-hmm. If they're not able to hold it, the resentment
just compounds, really.
Either compounds or it's like, fuck, I shouldn't have even said this. Look, they're not even listening to me. So you do have to trust your judgment as well. So it's complicated. Yeah.
This is the discernment piece. And also too, I mean, so many times in therapy, I'll say to people, but you're not saying it to them for a potential outcome, because it's not, you're actually not expressing your resentment. I get the idea that you are, but you're not actually expressing the resentment for any specific outcome other than practicing communicating what's going on for you. How the other person responds is actually not, that has something to do with you. It doesn't concern, that's on them. That's their thing, based on their stuff, based on their history, their lack of communication skills, whatever it is. But how they communicate back to you is just information for you about their capacity and their willingness to meet you. And then you get to do with that information what you will, but it's not your responsibility, and it's not your, it's not your responsibility. It's like your responsibility is to you, right? Not to them in a way.
Mm. But probably don't start with saying, hey, here are the 50 things I've written down that I'm resentful about that you have to fix.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
you're welcome. Yeah.
One of the things we talk about in the book is coming with your partner and not at or around. And so something that I carry will help me. So saying, here are the 50 things that you did wrong is coming at someone, right? That's a finger point of finger.
Yeah.
Saying nothing is going around someone, right? So to do life with someone means, hey, listen, here's how I feel. I'm not blaming you. I'm saying this because I want our relationship to grow. I'm showing myself. Can you hold that for
me? And my part to own in this, if we're saying socks, for example, my part to own in this is that I should have told you 5 years ago that picking up your dirty socks every day makes me feel like you don't value my time. I own that. I should have said that 5 years ago, and that's my part to own. And most of the time, if you come in with a component that is yours, that's also a really good way to kind of take that finger pointing out of it, because you're not putting all the blame on them. You do have a responsibility to own something in that.
Owning is hard. It's very adulting, you know, and blaming is easy. Mm-hmm. Our book is all about breaking the blame cycle.
Yep.
And in order to break the blame cycle, two people have to own whatever is their part. Usually one person does and the other person doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And
then yeah.
It doesn't work.
And then you just argue. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I think always potentially coming in with a solution too, saying, hey, I should have said something 5 years ago, and instead I've just been getting angrier and angrier, but I really don't like cleaning up after you, right?
Sure.
So instead, like going forward, could you either clean up after yourself, or maybe we can scrounge around some money and get a housekeeper? Otherwise, I'm going to be resentful forever. Sometimes. Maybe giving some ways out when you come with resentment problems too, being like, I understand that I contributed to this. It has to stop. Here's some maybe solutions. Are you open to any of the solutions? And if the other person's like, oh, you're mad at me, and they're not open to any of the solutions, then maybe there's more to work on. Yeah.
It's also telling of the relationship, one's capacity. Mm-hmm. Is this relationship fixable? You know, one's response is telling. It's like a dipstick, like you're checking oil, you know,
information.
And if what you're getting is always defensiveness, not once, because we could all be defensive, but right. If that's always when you come at someone, they're always defensive, I don't know if it's going to work, you know, because it's not sustainable. Mm. At least, with you know, family members are our family. So it's like,
it's different.
Yeah. Then you just, you know, don't come home for Thanksgiving or whatever, but send them the voicemail. But for intimate partners, because, you know, you're living with them, or if you are day to day, they're in your life, they're a huge part of your life. If people are defensive, it's just a matter of time. It may be years, but it's a matter of time where the legs fall out.
Years of a lot of resentment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's good to hear, because I know the way I was brought up with my dad was really like, I mean, what, half of marriages end in divorce. And it was very like, relationships are going to be tough, but you have to sort out your problems and make it work. But I think it's important. And I mean, I have a bias here because I'm divorced, but I think it's important for people to hear, sometimes it doesn't work and it's not you, and you can't negotiate your way out of it. And I think one of those signs, the ones that you just mentioned with, which was defensiveness. If you're saying, hey, here's a problem, here are some solutions. The other person's like, oh, you're mad at me? Like, it's like, well, if you can, how do you negotiate your way out of that if it's repeated?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it's what we were saying about this idea of it being information. It's like, I think when you say it, it's like people need to understand. And this is, I'm hoping there's a bit of a cultural shift happening in this idea. John, you said this before, like sometimes when people get divorced, rather than saying like, oh, I'm so sorry, or I'm sorry that happened, it's like, sometimes we should be giving that person like a trophy. Right?
A chest bump.
Yeah. Like we need to celebrate sometimes when people wake up and say, we're not in a good relationship and we're miserable and we need to leave this relationship. It doesn't matter whose quote unquote fault it is, right? Sometimes it's nobody's fault. Sometimes it just expires and you're different now than you were then. And that's okay. Right.
Some relationships are unfixable. You know, if two people have drifted so far that it's no longer about therapy, but feelings have changed and they're seeing their partner as just like, I have love for this person, but I'm not. And I'm just not attracted to this person anymore. I don't know if that's fixable. I don't know if, you know, maybe some cases it is, but some relationships just run out.
It's a shift to looking at relationships like time is not the indicator of a successful relationship, right? But like the depth and the safety and the security and the love is actually the indicator. And I think, I think our generation's a little bit different in that. I think we do look at things slightly different than like, past generations, grandparents that are like, we've been married for 70 years. And I'm like, you've been sleeping in separate bedrooms for 60 of those years, you know? I mean, no offense to separate bedrooms. I would actually love that, but I'm just saying, you know, that's the way people look at it. So
that hurts my feelings.
But I really like my sleep.
Don't
No, I get that. Oh my gosh. Especially since having a kid, I don't know your experience since having a kid. It's like, don't move the blanket. You're moving the blankets. I can feel the blankets move. And now I'm awake.
Yep.
Now I'm awake. And you're
asleep.
Now
she's awake. And now she's awake. Now I'm awake.
If Vanessa had her way, we'd be in two different houses. We'd be in two different houses on the same block.
Maybe. I'm not going to lie. I would have kind of loved that. That's the avoidant in me. I'm like, oh God, I would love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I get the bed thing. I've briefly considered, I think it somewhere in Europe, maybe it was Switzerland, I can't remember. They have two twin beds and you push them together and that's just the bed. And I was like, that would just solve the, it's not wanting to be close. It's the like, I wake up and then I'm awake and then my, like, I'm tired.
Yeah.
And I think that's like exacerbated from like some sort of brain change having a kid. It's like just wrecked my, destroyed my sleep.
Like you said, I mean, somebody breathes in the room. And
I know.
I think that's like a biological mom thing for sure. And
yeah, that's awful.
Like he's like snoring away and I'm like, you know, I heard something and I'm just like laying there awake for hours and I can't get back to sleep. So
I use like blast white noise.
I do too.
Like blast it. That helps a little bit.
But she hates. So I do the same thing. He's like, oh, I can't sleep. And I'm like, well, one of us.
I need that. Yeah. Oh, lucky Jordan likes the white noise. That's good. I have like white noise and like a mask that goes around my eyes and my ears and just everything. So
you need to be in one of those chambers, like where you're floating.
Yeah.
There's no.
Yeah. Exactly. That would be great with white noise. Okay. I want to ask a little bit more about your book. I had a list of questions, but I didn't really get to any of them. But I think we covered kind of. Yeah. I think we covered a lot about the, I think one thing that I really was missing was when do you say no? And when I grew up with people who were pretty, I think pretty aware of the need to negotiate. Like you can't be resentful. I've known that since I was like tiny. It was like, you can't be resentful. This is what resentment feels like. Don't do things that make you resentful. But then there was that on one hand and also like, but you have to do these things. I was like, well, now I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. But you know, hopefully people who listen to this podcast will have learned something.
Hopefully.
What was the most, I can't imagine writing a book with somebody else after, because I've spent way too long writing the book that I will eventually publish. Like I've been writing off and on for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine having, and it's like my baby, like you said,
right.
How did you guys like negotiate what was important to put into the book? Was that hard?
Yeah, I think you have to, you're writing through the lens of what you're creating is bigger than you. I mean, it's like having a child again, right? Mm-hmm. So I have to let go of the fact that I own this book, that it's
yeah.
my book. And Vanessa does as well. So we're creating something that is a collaboration, right? So, you know, even if you're in a band, right? If you guys don't agree, the music's not going to be good. So, yeah, it's a lot of, okay, there are some, you know, pick your battles. And if you feel strongly about something, that you should definitely express it again, so you don't have resentment. But at the end of the day, this thing that you're creating is bigger than you. So when you are co-authoring with someone, you have to respect the other person as an artist as well.
I think the good thing about this kind of book, you know, this nonfiction kind of self-betterment realm, that was, it's probably easier than say, if we co-wrote like a fiction book, is that
it's
pretty easy for us to say, here's the, again, to use kind of the number, arbitrary number 10, here's the 10 things that we know for certain our couples that we work with struggle with. And then we also know for certain we struggle with, right? And there were some, I think that probably got chopped onto the cutting room floor, whatever they say, you know, or things that maybe he brought that I hadn't thought of. But for the most part, the bulk of them, it was like, and I hate to say this to anybody listening, but like, you're not that unique. Like we all struggle with this shit. You know what I mean? I find solace in that. Somebody else might not.
Yeah, but it's great.
It really was that simple. Like, here's the shit we all struggle with. And it's really important that we touch on all of these. And then it really just became like, how do we touch on them? You know, whose part is what and who gets to go into it more. But that part felt fluid because it really was like, oh, you know, we have a whole chapter on codependency. Well, codependency is my jam. So it felt appropriate that that was kind of like the angle that I went through, you know? So that part played itself out, but yeah, it felt very much like this is the everyman's guide to couples because it's what we see all the time.
Yeah. And your book's very different because it's a memoir. It's a memoir. It's very personal. Yeah. So yeah. You're not going to be able to write that with someone else. No. Like someone's not going to be able to tell your story except you. Right.
Plus I would feel so like somebody's peeking behind a curtain, right? I almost feel like that would feel invasive if somebody was in your Google Doc while you were writing your memoir.
Yeah, this part isn't exactly how it should go. Yeah. Just edit that part a little bit. Right. Okay. Well, I'm going to link your book below.
Yeah.
But for social media, if people want to follow you guys online or find your book or find out what you guys are doing, where can they go?
Mine's just at The Angry Therapist.
Across everything. He's easy. I'm not. I'm kind of all over the place, but mostly Instagram and TikTok. So Instagram, I'm at Vanessa S. Bennett. And then TikTok, I'm at The Coda Yoda. And then you can get the book wide. Actually, September 6th is when it launches. So we're excited.
Wow. Congratulations. Well, for anyone listening, I would recommend reading this book. Vanessa was very helpful to me. And I think it's good for people, even if you've grown up in a stable family, I think it's probably a good read to make sure, especially if you're in a relationship and you're like, this could be better. There are things you're missing. Like, I think there are probably ways to either address that or to figure out if you actually shouldn't be in that relationship.
Yeah.
You shouldn't just be like hanging out, being completely unhappy.
Yep. Yeah. I think the point of this too, is it's like, we couldn't cram this every detailed thing into one book. So this idea of it being kind of like the everyman's guide, it's not to minimize it, but it's to say you'll get a good read. And then if there's something that jumps out at you, then you'll have enough information to say, oh, I need to dig into that specific topic deeper, right? Like whether it's the overfunctioning, underfunctioning dance, whether it's, you know, all these other things, desire types. We talk about different desire types. And then you can say, oh,
that's cool.
Yeah, I should research that more, you know, and then it kind of gives you that like launch pad.
Know what your partner's into before you ask if you could slap them. that's a tip at the end.
That's great. Okay. Well, thank you both very much for coming on. It was nice to see you again.
Yeah, you too. I appreciate you.
Thank you for having us. And thank you for creating a dialogue about relationships. That's I think it's much needed in the world.
Agreed.